Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Local Edition, and I'm still Jason Dole. Thank you for being here with me. Thank you for staying here with me if you were here with us for All Things Considered. Well, coming up on this program, folks with a history that precedes the era when this region was a colony are now making art that challenges that colonial legacy. Julia Kim checks in with the Forge Project, an indigenous-led nonprofit in Columbia County focusing on and promoting indigenous art. But first up tonight, we're going to continue our coverage of how the Trump administration's broader cuts to the public services is impacting local communities in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. The Woodstock Library recently expanded into a bigger building, but they are now facing some big cuts. The impact of funding for public libraries would not only be a loss for intellectual curiosity, it would be especially devastating for rural communities. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett spoke with Ivy Gocker of the Woodstock Public Library District and Jen Park and Grace Riario of the Ramapo Catskill Library System about how libraries in New York are funded, why federal support is so important, and they also talked about all the services that libraries offer, some of which you may not even know about. Let's go to the audio.
In March 2025, the Trump administration put out an executive order to eliminate the Institute for Museum and Library Services, also known as the IMLS. The IMLS is the federal agency that supports libraries, archives, and museums across all 50 states and U.S. territories. While 21 attorneys general brought the Trump administration to court over this order, the agency's employees were put on leave for days, and several state library systems had grants rescinded. The Woodstock Library is just one of many rural libraries in New York State who are feeling the direct impact of these cuts. After building a new 12,000-square-foot library space, the library is now facing a $300,000 budget deficit and is running a capital campaign to secure donations to cover the cost. While the funding of public libraries is something that can have long-term effects on the communities they serve, Ivy Gawker, director of Woodstock Public Library District, first clarified how libraries are funded across New York State, but why federal funding is still crucial, especially for rural libraries.
So public libraries in New York State, we don't typically get direct federal funding from the IMLS. The way IMLS affects us is there's a grants to states program, which is mandated by the U.S. Senate, and that takes money from IMLS and distributes it to every state across the country. And states handle that money differently. So in some states, that money does go directly to local libraries. In New York State, that money from IMLS funds the New York State Library. And so they're kind of a top-level administrative agency that distributes New York taxpayer funds throughout the state and has special grant initiatives, supports the state's own archives, all of that. So the threat for us and for other libraries in the area, when the original order to end the IMLS came out, was that that agency in New York would go away, which would affect New York's ability to give its own tax dollars to its libraries. And then much more immediately of impact to Woodstock was that the state library construction aid project would be in trouble because, again, that grant is administered through the New York State Library.
While the executive order calling for the elimination of the IMLS, along with six other agencies, cited, quote, continuing the reduction of the federal bureaucracy, unquote, libraries throughout New York State that rely on funding from the New York library system are making the case that they are providing a valuable service at a low cost to their communities. Jen Park, government relations specialist of the Ramapo Catskill Library System, discussed how the return on investment in public libraries at the federal level is not something that should be overlooked.
Really, in our area, for every dollar that is invested into libraries, the return on investment is $7. You know, you're not going to get that anywhere else. I mean, go to a bank. You know, what's the interest rate there that you're going to be obtaining on your CDs or what have you? So really, we are doing work that is providing so much back into the livelihood and the infrastructure of the state.
According to an IMLS study published in 2018, 4 out of 10 of America's libraries are based in rural areas, defined as those falling outside of urban areas. In addition, prior to the pandemic forcing more virtual and online learning, public libraries were already using technology to provide more e-books to those in rural areas, as well as providing Wi-Fi and internet access to those who might not otherwise have it.
How much money your local library has is very dependent on the size of your community, the income levels of your community. But I think what we all recognize is that the libraries are necessary no matter what the community is. They're more necessary in these rural communities where a lot of the services that libraries offer aren't replicated in other local institutions. So federal funding to things like the state library or the Mid-Hudson Library System ensure that no matter where you live in New York State, whether it's a wealthy county or a less wealthy county or community, you're going to have a consistent level of service.
Library staff are always willing to work with their community members to answer questions and provide thoughtful solutions to problems. However, as book bans began to take effect throughout the pandemic and especially into the second Trump presidency, library staff are dealing with administrative and financial overload. Grace Riario, director of Ramapo Catskill Library System, which works directly with the American Library Association to report on books being banned, talked about the financial burden of book bans.
It has cut the ability of libraries to spend money in services because now the staff has to spend hours following through somebody's opinion about a book. Because you don't like the lifestyle of a group of people does not mean that the library gets not to have that representation, right? Mm-hmm. So the policies that the libraries have in place have a process that you are welcome to put for complain an opinion about a material, but that takes time. It takes the time of the staff. It takes the time of the board. I believe there have been some libraries that have actually put it in numbers. So if you have 10, 20 complaints, that's equal to $30,000 in time, resources that you could have spent somewhere else, right? That will say that's the biggest cut, but that cut you don't feel because it's part of the budget. You feel it in the staff when, you know, story times and reference questions and going out to the community can't happen because we need a librarian to handle the opinion of an individual based on nothing because most people don't read the books that they complain about. Public libraries are here for everyone, and that means we represent the voices of the community that we live in. Whether we like those voices or not, that is no point of reference here. That's the whole thing of creating a public library. It was to provide the community that lives in it whatever information, education, or curiosity they may have.
Still, both those at Woodstock and Ramapo Catskill are working to let people know just how much you can get out of public libraries, with benefits stretching far beyond just books and a place to study.
There's so much that we do that people may not even realize. So, for example, we have a program called Vet Now, in which it's a vet-to-vet program that assists those who have come out of the service and who are moving forward with, you know, finding jobs and, you know, creating their resume. You know, that's a service that we provide. We assist in job resume creation, any sort of technology assistance. You know, if someone comes into the library not quite sure how to work a new piece of technology, we have a digital navigator program that we work in tandem with a couple other library systems with. So there is so much that we do that people don't know, and it's having those conversations to continuously highlighting these areas that you know, once these things are lost, they're lost. And we just need people to know the importance of libraries so that it does not come to that. There are libraries that lend tools for home improvement. There is a library in Rockland County that has a robust baking pan collection. So if you wanted to make a soccer ball cake, you could. You didn't have to go out and buy anything, right? We are saving you money in order for you to benefit your lives.
We are very lucky to have a state library that has invested a significant number of millions of dollars into a collection to provide access to people that are blind. And for that reason, local libraries don't have to spend money buying Braille books. When the IMLS comes and gets caught, the people that develop that collection, manage that collection, and make sure that people that are blind or became blind or have hearing issues are able to get access to education books, books of entertainment, even a magazine just to laugh, that all is going to be gone because the people that manage that are paid by the federal funding.
We are cooling centers when it's 95 degrees out with 97% humidity, right? We are warming centers when it's also just below freezing outside. We are for education, for entertainment, in all facets of life, from the youngest to the oldest, right? We are just there to enhance and support the population, just the people.
While U.S. District Judge Richard Leon had previously agreed to halt the Trump administration in cutting IMLS funding in May 2025, he reversed his decision 1 month later. We were talking about the IMLS going away, and not only are they making the operations more difficult and it's hurting the development campaign that you have going on, but the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Office actually found that the Trump administration broke the law in withholding these funds. Are there any kind of statewide lawsuits that the Woodstock Public Library is looking to join on to?
For this year, New York State is receiving those funds that it's supposed to get. And the State Library Construction Aid Program for this year will move ahead as planned. And Mid-Hudson System will get their allotment as expected. But is there going to be a different approach next year? Is it going to be written out of the budget entirely? So this is where several years of uncertainty start to stack up on top of each other, even if we're somewhat safe for now.
Now, Woodstock, Ramapo Catskill, and library systems across the country look toward the future simultaneously with uncertainty and yet a reliance on community.
We've been fundraising for this project since 2022, and we've raised over $1 million already. That was even before, you know, outside of anything that's happening in the immediate political sphere. I think the people in this community have, you know, they voted for this project in the first place so that we could move forward with building a new library. And then they've contributed financially since then. So, I mean, we're seeing that's been consistent and that's helpful. And then just, you know, more anecdotally, patrons are coming in and with questions of like, what is happening? What's happening to libraries right now? Like, what can I do? You know, so we try to have resources out and available so that people can be advocates. But one thing I will say is that the great thing about a library is even though we are receiving funding that is dependent on the state or on the federal government, it is still very much a local institution. So I think when you see things like book banning drives or any kind of censorship, you often also see immediately like the community upswell of support. And so as long as libraries are still able to connect directly with the communities they serve, that helps us be resilient as we're pulled into politics.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
And thank you, Genevieve, for that report. This is the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. And remember, we are looking for your support for this radio station that brings you local news, not just 7 days a week, but we bring you local news and talk programs 5 days a week, morning and evening. The Local Edition is your evening local news program. Please donate to support this station. Call now, 845-482-4141, or go to wjffradio.org. We got to get to our next story, and this one is about art. The Hudson Valley is known for its art history, and you may have heard of the Hudson River School during the 19th century. It spearheaded the Romanticism movement in the U.S., producing an extensive collection of paintings of the natural landscape that we're famous for. But the Forge Project, an indigenous-led nonprofit located on the unceded land of the Mohicanuk community in Columbia County, argues that it's a colonial legacy, one that has erased the very existence of indigenous people in this region, alongside their foundational contributions to American arts and culture. Established in 2021, the local organization has been working to challenge that erasure. Though a combination of supporting emerging indigenous artists working directly with the indigenous tribes and advancing land remediation and research projects, Forge specifically aims to deconstruct the institutional barriers that have long guarded the art world. Radio Catskills' Julia Kim spoke with Executive Director and Chief Curator Candace Hopkins, or Director of Indigenous Programs and Relationality, Sarah Biscara-Dilley, on the journey of the nonprofit itself, the organization's ongoing projects, and the structural issues they aim to address, and how racism and settler colonialism have been critical to the development of Western art. Here's that story now.
One of the things that kind of particular movement, we can say, and landscape painting, which is, you know, the distinct history of the Hudson River painters here, but also this is told many other places, is that this is their cultural practice of imagining a world that is present for their exploitation. And so those images, to me, are more of a case study on settler colonialism than they are a representation of indigenous worlds, because this is what they imagine.
The Hudson Valley is no stranger to the arts. Think of Thomas Cole's monumental paintings that came out of the Hudson River School of the mid-19th century. His romantic depictions of the serene river lined with pine trees or cascading shots of the Catskills Mountains the region is famous for. But what these historical paintings of the natural landscape here noticeably lack are people, specifically its original inhabitants. Forge Project, an indigenous-led nonprofit located on the unceded land of the Mohicanuk community in Columbia County, has been working to interrogate the artistic legacy. Established in 2021, the organization aims to elevate contemporary indigenous artists and cultural practitioners and expand their leadership within these domains. It is led by an indigenous steering council composed of 7 indigenous leaders and has a working relationship with the nearby Stockbridge Muncie community in Wisconsin, where many members are descended from the Mohican who inhabited upstate New York before they were forcibly displaced by settlers. Sarah Biscara-Dilley is Forge's Director of Indigenous Programs and Relationality and Indigenous Multidisciplinary Artists themselves. After introducing themselves in their native Northern Chumash language to start their interview with Radio Catskill, Dilley said the nonprofit's focus on supporting contemporary indigenous artists and cultivating relationships between them through their on-site programming is about directly challenging the legacies of settler colonialism. This includes not only the removal of indigenous tribes from the Hudson Valley region, but also the, quote, past tensing of indigenous communities as no longer existent in the face of this country's continuous attempts at cultural assimilation and physical elimination.
Hachu Hachu Mita Sarah Baskara Dili, Wamitana Ikitana Smuntil Hinkatiju, Kisru Chichu Kaata Kashla Ni Sithala, Wa Samimu, Wa Sitakawayu, Wa Tisimasu, Wa Etsmal, Wa Sitakaka, Wa Sitakaya, Wa Elawehe, Wa Asaram, Wa Casas Grandes, Wa Zinapekuro, Wa Santa Catalina, Wa Sikpats, Wa Silko Shoyo, Wa Waimeya, Wa Sitakawa. Tiokiam nipu needs bu teachu sa itaramansi, mitakana misakana wa mi kinahua na needs bu til hinkatichu, wa yakistono, wa yakitanasmu, wa yakisisime, wa University of California Davis ni Native American Studies, wa Forge Project ni Director of Indigenous Programs and Relationality. Saying hello, my name is Sarah Biscara-Dilley. I'm letting you know that I come from good people, from villages, primarily throughout Yaktichu-Tichu, Yaktilhini homelands, which are in the central coast of California, where
about halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles on the coast. I also have genealogical connection to villages in southern Sweden, some in central Mexico, and one on the Big Island of Hawaii. I live in Munsee-speaking people's homelands, and I'm letting you know that my knowledge comes from my language, my family, our homelands. I have a PhD in Native American Studies from UC Davis, and I currently serve as the Director of Indigenous Programs and Relationality here at Forge.
I'm wondering if you could go into, you know, where does the Forge Project kind of fit into challenging that historical legacy within the Hudson Valley, within the Catskills, of really bringing Indigenous artists and their visions of themselves and their land?
You know, I would say quite simply, it's through affirming our existence. It's choosing to center our narratives and the like inherent diversity of the worlds that we're speaking from. We have a growing collection of contemporary Native art. We have around 180 pieces in the collection right now. That is part of a lending collection. So those, you know, we get to enjoy works that are like at rest or they're not in the show. But at any point in time, I believe it's 30 to 60 works are on view in exhibitions nationally and internationally. But while, you know, we get to enjoy the pieces here. So some of that is just really presence. We do a lot of work to really support Indigenous cultural practitioners. Our fellowship serves not just artists, but cultural practitioners of all kinds. We have a fellowship. There are 6 spots every year. Of those 6 spots, 2 are guaranteed to Stockbridge Munsee community members or descendants, first and second line descendants, in recognition of our responsibility to homeland communities. Resident or fellows are welcome to come spend up to 3 weeks in residence on the campus here, but it's not a requirement of the fellowship. Each fellow is given an unrestricted cash award of $25,000 in recognition of their practice. So it's really about just recognizing the work that is already happening within Native communities. And one of the parts of the position that I steward that I really love is also facilitating convenings for Indigenous people. We have a convening coming up in the fall that is called Confluence. It's an Indigenous art criticism residency. So it's also trying to not only support artists and cultural practitioners, but also to support the deepening and expansion of like critical responses to it. We want more Indigenous people writing about Indigenous art. I also want more Indigenous people writing back to those kind of art historical histories that were, or this context that we were talking about earlier.
Candace Hopkins, Forge's executive director and chief curator, as well as a citizen of the Carcross Tagish First Nation in Canada, said they've been able to support more than 300 Indigenous cultural workers as a result of these different programs. Specifically, the lending collection of 180 works has expanded to be one of the leading collections of its kind in the United States. When you enter Forge's main residence, you'll likely encounter some of these works on display, such as a large-scale photograph of Tlingit Inanga artist Nicholas Glennon's installation Never Forget, wherein 45-foot letters spelling the words Indian Land were mounted outside of Palm Springs in reference to the Hollywood sign back in 2021.
I feel like what we can do as an organization ultimately is to change the narrative. So one example is our lending collection of contemporary Native art. We use that not only to build knowledge about the incredible artists who've been making this work since time immemorial, essentially, but we use it to put pressure on, right? Like we ask questions like, why was the last group exhibition of Native art at the Museum of Modern Art, you know, why did that take place in 1942? Why hasn't there been one since? Why was the only solo exhibition in 2020? You know, why have these major collections of contemporary American art, you know, really ignored the work of Native artists? That's both, I think, passive and really conscious marginalization of Native artists.
This comes as the art world has increasingly faced criticism in the last few decades for its dealing of Indigenous cultural objects to fill the inventories of museums like the American Museum of Natural History. Although the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, otherwise known as NAGPRA, was passed in 1990 to address the right of Indigenous communities to have museums and federal agencies return stolen human remains and sacred objects, the process of repatriation has often been a painful one, Dilley, who had served on the University of California's NAGPRA Oversight and Implementation Committee, said. Furthermore, they explained that the institutional exclusion of Indigenous voices has contributed to not only this issue, but also the whitewashing of Indigenous artistic traditions. Your website said something really interesting that I wanted to ask if you could kind of expand upon. And that is, quote, "We recognize Indigenous art as the foundation of all contemporary art, not simply as a facet of our history or historical context."
You know, I think it's something that has always rubbed me the wrong way, that there needs to be this specific delineation as, oh, there's the history of American art that starts at the moment of settlement. It starts with European introduction, rather than looking at the fact that there has been long, complex, layered, influential, material art histories that begin in this place and existed long before the conceptualization of America. I think part of what maybe planted the seed for that, like, I'm going to talk about this dissonance, is that I was really privileged to have started my undergrad at the Institute of American Indian Arts, which is the only tribal art school in the United States. But I really credit IAA with offering this kind of foundation where our art historical canon is taught at the center. It gave me that fire that I needed to be able to write from that place of directness, where I'm like, I don't have any question about whether or not our contributions and the ways that our practices have been absolutely influential to capital A art. You know, Indigenous people invented abstraction, and I'm talking about globally. There are so many movements in art history that are directly connected to the contributions of Indigenous people all over the world, and like those contributions have been erased.
But in their desire to disrupt rather than reproduce the harm institutions have enacted against Indigenous communities, Forge has had to critically look inwards as well. The nonprofit recently shifted from being a private organization to a nonprofit led by the Indigenous Steering Council, which is intentionally modeled after traditional forms of collective governance in Indigenous communities. In addition, they have also established a memorandum of understanding with the Stockbridge Munsee community, whose ancestral lands they occupy.
I was really privileged to work alongside Monique Tyndall, who's the Director of Cultural Affairs at Stockbridge Munsee Community. And we just started by having conversations. I think the first email I sent to her, I just asked, you know, what are your ongoing initiatives and like, how can we lighten your load? Instead of coming to them with a preconceived idea of how we were going to work together, which is often what organizations are doing. So we spent the better part of a year co-writing a memorandum of understanding. And that was done really with that diplomatic intent. It was also done collaboratively so we could map out commitments and deliverables that actually made the most sense for the community. There was a lot of kind of alignment with the Cultural Affairs Department, which is why that's where the relationship lives. But when we had the completed MOU, it was looked over by, you know, the tribe's lawyers, and it was voted in by their tribal council. So we're really trying to recognize the sovereignty of their government through how we're working with them. So we mapped out 3 years of deliverables. This year, we've been like getting to do the fun part of it, which is like actually implementing some of the programs. And that's been really wonderful to get to do collaboratively. But it's also an MOU that requires like re-engagement and renewal every 3 years so that the deliverables stay aligned with the most emergent needs of the community. But then there's also that, again, building in that responsibility of relation into how we're doing things.
Hopkins said this also means that they do not take the land they are located on lightly. In addition to the work they do within the art realm, the nonprofit is also engaged in land remediation and research efforts. They've reintroduced native species in the meadow that sits below the hilltop with their two residences, as well as developed a cultural easement agreement with the Stockbridge Munsee community that encourages their cultural access to and stewardship of the land. And you've kind of more touched on it, but I was wondering if you could go more into, you know, why it's important that the actual land the Forge Project is located on serves as a major pillar of the work you guys do.
The health of the land will be our legacy. You know, buildings have temporary lifespans. If we think of things in the age of like land or geologic age, right? We are into extraordinary buildings that were designed by the artist and activist Ai Weiwei. But one of the first things we did was, you know, the land we're situated on, which is Mohican land, traditionally, historically, it was all mown and tended lawn. Lawn, the particular kind of lawn grass, you know, we learned this through botanists that we collaborate with, Claudia Nab Vispo from Hawthorne Valley Farmscape Ecology, is actually originally from Northern Africa. you know, the Hudson Valley now is a place of a lot of introduced species of plants. But I also think that there's, you know, it's also witness to a kind of world out of balance. That's why we have such a bad tick epidemic. You know, climate change shifts our ecosystems quite radically. So one of the first things that we did was engage with Misty Cook, who's a plant knowledge holder from Stockbridge Munsee community. She did a plant analysis for us. Then we started engaging with Claudia and, you know, other really deep allies and knowledge holders. And we worked with them to welcome back native seeds to the land.